Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. I wanted to start this podcast with a brief testimonial from Coach Mitchell. Coach Mitchell wrote, "Chris, I heard you speak at a clinic in Oregon and joined Basketball Immersion shortly after. Just wanted to say thanks for all your help this season. Utilizing a games approach and small-sided games have been huge in helping develop my players. I had the best and most competitive practices in my 7-year career as a coach. The kids really enjoyed the new practices. More importantly, listening to you and reading your website really helped me develop a greater love for coaching and basketball in general. It got me back to my core of why I coach. I realized for years I had been doing certain things in practice for no other reason than I thought this is what coaches do. Getting back to the core of letting the kids compete and grow through challenges was huge for my coaching development. It is inspiring to get messages like these from Coach Mitchell and other coaches. I am so happy so many coaches have stimulated their coaching within our basketball immersion community. If you are not yet a member, I encourage you to check it out. www.basketballimmersion.com/sign-up.
Coaches, on today's podcast, someone who has been coaching at the same school for 42 years, Coach Harry Peretta. Coach, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Coach, I've heard your name for a long time, and you've been someone that shared the game with your five-out offense and your unscoutable zone offense, stuff like that. So I've certainly known about you, but I didn't quite know your legacy. And 42 years at the same school at Villanova, and that tied you, which I was amazed there was someone that tied you with as the longest serving coach in the women's game at one school, which is amazing. And going into the season, you ranked on the winningest active Division I collegiate coaching list, 13th all time, and you had 765 wins, and then you have more now. But coach, why did you stay at one school for 42 years?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. I got out of college and I was looking for a coaching job, any coaching job, high school. I had a teaching degree and my goal was to be a high school teacher and a high school coach. That was my goal. So I got right out of Lycoming College and I saw an ad in the paper and it was for women's basketball. They were looking for a head coach at Villanova and one at St. Joe's. And I had coached at Lycoming College where I went to school while I was a junior and a senior. The head coach made me his assistant, and he also made me the head JV coach of the boys team. So I had some coaching experience. So when I applied for both positions, I got an interview at Villanova because I was only 22. I never thought I would get the job coaching women. But the weird part was that the woman that hired me, I didn't even know this at the time, but her husband had played at Lycoming before I did. So it works out where I get the job. The Lycoming coach gives me a good recommendation and she hires me. So it was kind of like a strange thing to even get there in the first place. And then after I got there, the Augustinians run Villanova. The Augustinian priest also run the high school that I went to. So a lot of the people who taught me in high school were now stationed at Villanova. And when I got here, it was kind of like I knew them already. And it just felt like a very home atmosphere, very loving atmosphere. And I just felt like, you know, I just grew into it where I never felt like I should leave. I just felt like it was my home.
Yeah, well, and obviously what a home it's been for all these years. And getting into the basketball stuff, you've made a huge impact on the basketball community with your sharing. I'm curious, in developing these systems, I mean, the five out, the spread continuity and the unscoutable zone offense, it seems to me that you develop these a little bit with a mindset of an underdog playing against some of the bigger schools. Is that my thinking? Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Everything that I've developed, I've tried to use from the aspect of I wasn't a very talented player. And my mentor taught me how to make up for what I couldn't do from the physical standpoint or the talent standpoint by moving without the ball, moving intelligently, and things like that. So everything that I ever came up with on the offensive end of the floor was based upon that. And also, I always felt like, hey, if you're a really good player, you could just play within this type of system too and that this system could help you get some easier shots, but you also could use your individual talents to get your own shots. And that's kind of like what we tried to develop within the system. So you're correct. Everything that I did was from the aspect that we would be an underdog.
Well, and let's start with the zone offense, because honestly, we haven't spent enough time on zone probably throughout my podcast. So it's awesome to have someone who's developed zone offense. And you mentioned this already, it's about incorporating some of your other players. But from the zone offense perspective, I mean, the players both have freedom and responsibilities. Can you explain
Correct.
That?
Correct. Yeah. I remember when I first started out coaching in college, I just basically ran 1-3-1 or 2-1-2 and things like that. And you know, it was very easy to match up with us. And I realized that, hey, I need to do something a lot more different than I'm doing here. And I remember I went to see Bobby Knight. I went to see some other coaches. Rolly Massimino was obviously at Villanova when I was here. And what I tried to do was, anytime in my coaching career, I would try to take different people's concepts and add them together. Because I always heard coaches saying, oh, no, we're going to do it this way, or we're going to do it this way. So I felt like, hey, why don't we do it both ways? And I said, isn't that a better way of doing things? And that's how my concept of the zone offense began. It's based around leaving a spot when you pass the ball, filling another spot. It's based around, I started it out with three different kids that used to flash into the high post. And this is how you learn stuff in life. The three kids were flashing into the high post, and I didn't think they were catching the ball enough. And this actually happened to me one week. I had my son, Steven, who was like about, I don't know, 5 years old. And we went to this ice cream store, and there were like 80 different flavors of ice cream. So it took him about a half hour to make up his mind what flavor he wanted. Then later on in the week, we went to a corner store, and the guy said at the corner store, he goes, you know, we only have one designated flavor, chocolate. So Steven immediately said he wanted chocolate. So I said to myself, wait a minute, why don't I make a designated flasher instead of having multiple flashers? So I went to practice next day, started working on it. And what I found was the designated flasher actually was catching the ball more than the three different kids that were flashing, because everybody on the team knew who that person was. People on the team would compete for that spot. And it started working out really well. And what I mean about the designated flasher is when people leave a spot and fill a spot on the perimeter, obviously they're leaving a spot open. The designated flasher could step from inside out to any spot on the court, then flash into the high post, step out again. So you would go from four people being out against the zone to five people out against the zone, then to four again. And it just started to work so well. And everybody would learn where to move, how to move. And it was like we used to do it as a whole. Like we didn't do any breakdown drills. I used to just do it 5-on-5 was the best way to learn it. And again, it was based upon, hey, not having to pound the ball inside because we didn't have those kind of players. It was based upon tricking the defense. So that's how the whole concept kind of like worked its way in. And then I used it, showed it to different people over the years. I remember showing it to Larry Brown. And I never screened against the zone, but Larry Brown used to like to screen. He showed me how to screen the flasher, then flash the person into the high post. So every time I talked to somebody, I would learn something different and then try to add it into this particular offense.
I love the process you just shared with us, because again, I mean, through all your years of coaching, you've obviously tweaked it, you've added, you've subtracted. And through that whole process, you're just trying to find a way to make it most successful for your current team. And I'm wondering about that adaptability to personnel specifically. Number one, let's start with the flasher. Who do you determine is the best flasher?
Well, the best flasher is somebody who can make a three, also make a high post shot, be able to pass the ball, and it also has to be a smart player. So they have to have those four ingredients in what they do. And usually on a team, like I have what, 11 people on the team now. I have three different kids that flash. So not all the kids will have all those qualities. So they're the ones I'm looking for in the flasher. So that person that can do a little bit of everything and also be able to be a leader and direct traffic, like tell kids, go this side or go this side. They have to also be a leader too.
Well, it's such a great point because, again, too often I think people predetermine someone that plays in the interior of a zone has to be a post. And obviously we're moving towards, you know, understanding that isn't the case. But this has always been the case for you, right? You put the best player for that spot in the middle of the zone.
That's correct. Yeah. The kid that does the most multiple things.
Yeah, that's great. And it's such an important place to be able to get the ball against the zone. And once you get the ball to the flasher, what actions are happening off the flasher? Are they holding spots? Is there movement? What are some options?
Basically, like if the flasher steps out and touches the ball, you're still leaving a spot and filling a spot, but you might be doing a little bit more stationary stuff. It's kind of like a feel where a certain position that the flasher steps out to, you might want to move a little farther away or a little closer. You might want to go through. And again, it's a read of the defense. And in some cases, I've said it before, like the zone offense, it isn't harder to learn. Sometimes it's harder to execute because you have to be able to read the defense and there's no set cuts. So you have to make up where you're cutting. So like I said, when the flasher steps out, you might want to move towards the flasher where you think you might get a shot. You might want to move away for a skip pass. So everything is determined on where the defense is.
Well, I love that you already said this about playing, like working the offense 5-on-5. I get asked all the time about breakdown drills in zone, and I'm like, here's my breakdown drill against zone, 5-on-5. Like, you
correct.
Just, you have to see the whole picture, right, Coach?
That's the way I teach it. Because I don't think you can, I mean, you can work on little drills with the flasher, stepping out, catching it, reversing it, flashing back in, but you have to know where all the other people on the court are. So to me, the best way to learn it is whole, you know, against a whole. And I will tell you, and I've told everybody else the same thing, if you determine that you want to try this kind of zone offense, you have to give it at least a week because it will look horrible in the first week that you try to do this because you're playing 5-against-5 and you're just learning how to read all the different positions on the court. So you have to be committed to it. I find that a lot of people might give up either the zone offense or a man offense after the first couple of days because it just looks too confusing. You have to be able to play through it.
Messy is okay. Messy is a part of learning.
I agree. I mean, that's the way we learn at Villanova.
That's great. So for all the players, just as we're looking at this, the other thing that I think is really important to note, and I think coaches waste too much time thinking about, is adapting or running different zone offenses to different types of zone defense. This is one zone offense that's adaptable to anything, right?
Correct. Well, the only one that's a little hard to run against is a 1-3-1 because the defensive team always has somebody at the high post guarding. But the flasher in that situation would then flash to the elbows instead of directly to the high post to try to avoid that defender. But you're correct. We use it against – we might start it in different formations. Sometimes we start in a 1-3-1. Sometimes we start in a high-low. Sometimes we start in a 2-1-2. Sometimes we start by waving. Like in a 1-3-1, we might dribble the ball to the wing and wave everybody through and rotate. Sometimes we'll start by passing from the point and then go find another spot. But how I teach it is once we do that first, whatever you want to call it, then I just say, assume your roles. And then everybody assumes the same exact role that they would have against any kind of defense.
And give us some examples of some of those roles for players that, say, aren't the flasher. What are some of those other
okay. roles? The perimeter people, their roles are to leave a spot, fill a spot. You can dribble the ball to create a pass. You can also dribble the ball to escape like a trap or an overplay. So the three perimeter players are using those rules to themselves. The low player, their job is to go short corner, and they may go as far as the corners to the three-point line if they can shoot it. We've sometimes put a guard back there and tried to get them the ball near the three-point line so they could drive it. So the low person's job is to move from side to side, trying to get themselves open behind the defense to try to draw the back of the defense to them. So those are what those two roles, those separate roles are. And then obviously the flasher's role is to be able, they can go anywhere on the floor. They can step out to any spot. They can flash whenever they want. They have to flash a little relative to the high post. They don't want to get too low because you don't want to have the high and the low person too close to each other. But their role is to be able to do a little bit of everything.
And what are the dominant shot profile that you're getting in the zone offense? Where the emphasis or where the analytics give you?
There's not the analytics is we get a lot of open threes, but we've had teams in the past where we would put a good player behind the defense and we would work to get them the ball a little bit more. And again, it depends on your personnel. The year that we went to the Elite Eight, we led the country in three-pointers attempted and made. This particular year, we shoot a lot of threes, but we don't shoot it very well. So it all depends on what kind of group of kids that you have and what they're good at. And you know, then we kind of curtail the offense to what we think we're better at.
And positionless, so it makes it easy for you to be able to adapt any player. Obviously, you get to recruit at your level, but any player can fit into this. But I'm wondering, are there some specific things that you adapt for some special types of players within this offense?
Well, we always try to recruit multi-faceted players, like kids that can all shoot, pass, and dribble. And if we can get kids between 5'11 or 5'10 and like 6'2, they can play any spot on the floor. That's what we're looking for, players that can play any spot on the floor. We have a kid in our team now. Her name is Mary Kadeka. When she first got here, she basically could only play the back spot. She couldn't shoot the ball for more than 15 feet. She was good around the basket, so she played the back spot against the zone almost always. Now she plays the flasher position where she's learned how to do multiple things. And even sometimes we use her at the point guard where we use her as a leave a spot, fill the spot player. So it all depends on how your players develop their individual skills. And if you have a bigger kid that's more immobile or not great away from the basket, then you would use them as a low post player. And maybe they wouldn't step all the way out to the corner. They might only go block to block, where when we're reversing it and we're leaving a spot, fill a spot, you might be able to get it into her at the low block.
And I'm asking specifically maybe for some high school coaches who maybe have a player they want to hide. So they don't have all skilled players. Maybe they have that one player coming off football season that's just a good athlete. Mm-hmm. So where would you put that player in this scenario?
I would put them at the low post.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would hope they'd be able to make a layup. That's why I would put them low, because it limits them having to dribble or pass the ball, make skill passes, make shots away from the basket. So it would limit them to just either offensive rebounding or catching the ball and trying to just lay it in.
So I read another quote from you that's basically about this offense, but I assume it applies to man too, so you can speak to both. But shots are not predetermined, but instead developed naturally based on your philosophy and your player's preference. Can you talk about how you define shot selection?
We define it like both man and zone. We just define it as a shot that we think is makeable. And a lot of times when you have a motion offense, the goal of the motion offense to me is to try to create enough open shots where the non-skilled players don't have to work as hard and can make. And then the skilled players, like I told you before, they can come in. If they take a contested shot over somebody or, you know, dribble the ball between two people, that's fine because that's what their skill level is. So that's how we determine what a good shot is. It's dependent on the person that takes it and what we think they can do.
Great, great. And you've talked about it a little bit, but playing with a person behind the zone, is that something that you don't see enough from other teams that's so important?
I guess so. I mean, I always felt like if you put somebody behind the zone that can at least make a layup or can be looked at, then you're freeing up the flasher a lot more to flash the ball into the medium post or the high post. It also, the wing players going through, you're drawing some of the defense away from them. So that's what I think is important. I think teams do put guys behind the zone, but I don't know if they put them behind in quite a way where they're getting into the game enough. Like, that's why I tell the big kids to step out to the short corner, because I want them to get in the game enough where they're touching the ball constantly. And then we'll go through drills at practice where we're not allowed to shoot the ball unless the bottom person touches it at least one time. So I think teams do it, but I don't know how much they emphasize it.
And another thing struck me as you're saying, so you talked about the messy part of learning this, which is natural and normal, but is it part of this learning process distinguishing the difference between a flasher and a normal cutter? Because players who aren't flashers can cut as well.
Correct. If you're not the flasher, as you're cutting through, you could be looking for the ball. So we've had times in games. I remember the team that was really good at it was a team that went to the Elite Eight. Like the flasher would step out. One of the perimeter kids who was cutting through would just happen to see an open spot on that particular possession, and they would flash to the high post and they would get the ball. So the bottom line is that, again, like you said, the messy part is learning it. But I also think how you learn it, especially 5-on-5, makes you better at it. So I just think that, you know, you can just do multiple things out of it. That's the thing I like the most. And like you said, it's positionless. So anybody can do anything, you know, if they have the skill level for it.
Can there be two cutters at once, or is that part of what you're trying to train them to make decisions to say, okay, first cut, then second cut, so that you're not looking at two things at once, or is that okay?
It very seldom does it happen, because the person that's cutting is usually the person that's passing. So when they pass the ball, they're leaving the particular spot they're in and they're cutting through or down. So usually it's one cutter. Usually it's one cutter. But I have seen times where somebody is cut, another person has seen something open and cut at the same time. Again, depending on the situation, it could be a great play, it could be a bad play. Again, and then I would stop it and say, hey, in this case, it was a good cut, two people cutting. In this particular case, you know, we shouldn't have had two people cutting. And the other funny thing, too, is there's times where you pass the ball and you don't even move where you're making a good cut. And people say to me, what do you mean? For example, if I'm on the wing and I throw the ball to the flasher who steps out to the high post, and the defender who's guarding me leaves me and goes and guards either the middle or the low. Well, now I don't even make a cut. I just stand there for a pass back. And I call that leave a spot, fill a spot, because in that particular situation, even though you're not moving, you are moving. You made the decision to stay, which to me is still making a decision. I know it sounds stupid, but that's how you're learning how to read the defense.
No, it's great. I understand that completely. And is skip pass something you value within this offense? Is that an emphasis?
Yes, yes. Skip passes are a big emphasis, because when the flasher starts stepping out, a lot of times the top person in the zone gets caught having to guard the flasher. That's when you can skip the ball over their head, maybe get a three on the weak side, or dump it in low right away.
And we always phrase it as the flasher, when they catch the ball, they look for themselves. And then the second look is look opposite, because obviously the way zone shifts and different things like that collapses. Is that similar, or do you have different ways of phrasing that for the flasher?
Yeah, I mean, I tell the flasher, I would say 7 to 8 times out of 10, you probably should reverse the ball. But yeah, if you get into a game where you notice the defender on the wing when the ball's being passed is dropping, then you can fake the pass and throw back. So we work on that too, reading the defense and faking the reversal and throwing it back.
Hey, Coach, just a brief interruption from the podcast to hear from one of our supporters, LinkedIn. The perfect hire can have an impact on your business for years to come. So when you need to find that next person to help grow your business, LinkedIn Jobs will match the right talent with your open role fast. I personally use LinkedIn, and I know many of you in the coaching profession do too. Did you know LinkedIn has over 675 million members worldwide? LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with the hard and soft skills you're looking for, so you can hire the right person fast. Things like collaboration, creativity, adaptability. LinkedIn looks beyond the work skills and puts your job post in front of qualified candidates who match your business requirements perfectly. That's how LinkedIn makes sure your job post is seen by the people you want to hire, people with the skills, qualifications, and other interests that will help your business grow. It's no wonder a person is hired every 8 seconds with LinkedIn. Find the right person for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first 50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/team. Again, that's linkedin.com/team to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Now back to the podcast.
Yeah, this boomerang action is so effective. Again, these zones obviously naturally shift in unison and they all move towards the ball, and then that leaves the same side exposed. So that's really cool that you said that. And the other thing that I'm wondering about, and talked about having a playmaker in the flasher spot, is I'm seeing this a lot internationally, is where an interior player pops out to become obviously a 3-point threat. And is that something that you've noticed has really developed over the years for your players, that ability to be able to go inside out to be able to shoot the three on a cut?
Yes. I mean, that's an important part of the flasher, being that particular person has the ability to shoot the medium range shot and be able to shoot the three. Because when you go inside out is when you really screw the defense up, because they're going from guarding like maybe three perimeter people up top to guarding four perimeter people. So that's when you get a lot of open threes. So yeah, we would like that person to be able to make threes.
And again, back to the high school coach scenario, that they have some perimeter players that maybe aren't as effective 3-point shooters. Would you emphasize more cutting for them on off the ball actions to be able to basket cut or short corner cut or different cuts like that?
Yeah, I would use that. Yeah, emphasize that. And the other thing I would do is what Larry Brown showed me. You could use them as, if you don't want them really shooting the three, you could use them as screeners a little bit, either on skip passes where you're kind of flare screening the top, or you can step up and go pick and roll with one of your guards who is a good shooter, and you can then flash that person low or across or high. So the person that doesn't shoot the ball could be used as a screener in the offense too.
And have you incorporated any ball screening in this offense?
No, but the funny thing is we're getting ready to go to the Big East tournament, and we think the team we're going to play against might play us a lot of zone. So we're actually going to put that in today, a little pick and roll stuff where we go pick and roll. And then if we don't get anything, we just assume our roles and then run the zone offense. But at least we're getting a pick and roll out of it.
That's great. Great inside information. Don't worry, Coach. They won't listen to this before the game anyway. That'd be great. So, and maybe on that, along that line, I mean, what I always like asking coaches that develop these unique or, you know, intelligent systems is, what are some things that can really disrupt it? What are some things that can disrupt it in your experience over the years? Because that kind of guides our thinking about, obviously, how to improve the offense or how to improve a defense or a zone defense.
The things that disrupt it the most are if you're trapping us, you can't run it. Because when you're trapped, you can't pass the ball and leave a spot because the person you're passing it to is getting trapped. You have to stay out and help them. So that's one thing that disrupts it. And the other thing is if you get out and pressure, try to cut the passing lanes off, then if you do that, then the people who are running the zone offense may have to dribble the ball a little bit more to create a passing lane. So that has become the one thing that might disrupt it a little bit. So those are the two different things, if you're going on a defensive side of the floor, that would have a chance to disrupt it. But once again, if you make the right pass against the trap, you should get a shot anyhow. And if you get out and pressure, and the other rule is, if I step out in the zone offense or I leave a spot and fill a spot and you deny me the ball, the same principle works against the zone that works against the man. If you're denied the ball, you back cut and fill the spot with somebody else. But if kids don't read it well enough and don't back cut, it can be disruptive to the offense.
And with your experience with the flasher, I just, again, want to search for some of the phrasing that you use. But so when you're teaching them to flash, you know, are you saying different phrasing, like you're cutting to space, not spots, which is a common problem that we all see, right? Where we talk about flashing in a zone and they just go to a designated spot. They go to the elbow. So what are some of the ways that you phrase and talk about the flasher getting space?
But what we do is, like, we'll have the coach with the ball stand up top and we'll dribble the ball to the wing pretending like we're waving people through. So now we'll put either chairs out there or we'll put two other defenders out there. Now the flasher has to read where to step out, you know, step out towards the ball, step out maybe away from the ball, depending on where the defense is, catch it, reverse it or throw back, flash back into the high post. But again, when you're flashing back to the high post, like you said, one time you might flash to the elbow. One time you might flash to the middle of the lane. One time you might flash a little deeper because the top person in the zone is playing back. You have to get behind them. And sometimes when the top person in the zone is all the way out at the 3-point line, you can flash in right behind them, which is all the way up at the foul line, and catch the ball. So those are the things that we try to teach them, and that's how we try to teach them, depending on where the defensive player in front of you is.
And then acting, deception, change of pace, different things like that factor into their success. Like the best flashers you've ever had probably had a little bit of this acting ability to be able to act like they're not going before they go.
Yeah, you know, just better players are just better players all around, and they know instinctively where to go, how to go there, when to fake go in there, when to go somewhere else, when to back cut, when to step towards the ball. So again, it's predicated a lot on, you know, how good that particular player is that's the flasher. And that's why usually on our team, the flashers are usually our top two or three players.
That's great stuff. And you talked a little bit about the difficulties against the 1-3-1. Is there something that you found, again, in knowing one of the weaknesses of your offense? Have you found some things that work best against the 1-3-1 then?
Yeah, we start more in the 2-1-2. The other defenses, we start more in a one in a high-low. So we start more in a 2-1-2 to try to gap the top person. And when we hit the corner, the flasher, sometimes the corner person in the zone goes and guards the corner. Well, we'll have the flasher step out to the wing a lot more instead of the top of the key. Because in the 1-3-1, they usually have a defender up there. So I found that the flasher stepping out to the wing, off center, when they step out and in, when they flash in, they're going more to the elbow instead of the mid post, because that's where the defender is. So that's what we try to do against a 1-3-1. And we dribble the ball a little bit more, because in a 1-3-1, you're cutting off passing lanes. So we might dribble the ball a little bit to try to create a passing lane more against a 1-3-1.
Great stuff. Thinking about now transitioning a little bit to the man offensive philosophy that you've helped develop, but relating it to the zone, do you number cuts in the zone too? I know you number cuts.
No.
In off. No. Okay.
No, we have them just cut on their own, and we don't. I don't say to them do a three, or I mean, I may occasionally, but we don't call numbers against the zone at all.
So the zone is complete freedom of movement in terms of read and make a decision.
And read then, and react. And, yeah.
Yeah, read and react, and then you have opportunities within your man to be able to designate specific actions or different things through this number. Can you talk about the numbers system?
Yeah, what I did with a friend of yours, Keith Freeman, we played them out in Oregon a long time ago. And he came up and he was showing me his offense, and I was showing him my offense. And after that, we were both running motion. But one day I went up to practice and I remember a kid saying to me, I said, move. And the kid really didn't move. And I said, well, why? She goes, I didn't know where to go. So I said to myself when I got home that night, I said, you know something, even though this sounds like first grade, but if I number the cuts 1 through 5, whatever, and I say to a kid, do a 3, well, they know it's a back cut. Or do a 4, they know it's a screen and slip. Or a 1, which is a pass and basket cut. Or a 2, which is a curl. 5 is a flare. So now when I give directions to somebody in a game, they know exactly what I want them to do, and they know exactly where to go. And I found that it became very helpful between the coach and player communication. And then it became helpful because then we started using, I remember Rolly Massimino, after he was retired from coaching, I told him to come up one day. And I told him, I said, can we make a numbered offense out of this or a sequence? And what we came up with was we come down and we'll call like a 25. And a 25 means that the first number we call, you're doing twice, which is a 2, which is curl. The second number we call is a flare. So now the rest of the possessions, you are flare screening for whatever person that you're supposed to flare screen for. And you do that the rest of the possession. So that's what we came up with. And I remember he wanted to try to use 3 numbers in a possession. I thought he was just making it too complicated. So I just stuck with the 2.
First of all, I'm trying to remember when Rolly Massimino retired from coaching. I was coaching against him when he was at Northwood, and unbelievable passion of the game. What a tremendous resource for you to be able to adapt some of these ideas. So in a possession, you can call 1 number or you can call 2 numbers, but it would never be 3 numbers.
Correct. We don't use 3. We just think it's too complicated.
And then within are there individual players that you can designate as 1 number for the whole possession?
Sometimes we do that. And remember the number one rule. The number one rule is basketball knowledge, or I don't know what you want to call it, perception, whatever, supersedes the number. For example, if I pass the ball and I go and screen away from my teammate and we're supposed to do a 2, which is a curl. If the kid is playing the offensive player, if the defender is playing the offensive player on the high side, well, now basketball knowledge overrules the number. she does a three instead of a two because she's overplayed. She does a back cut. So always remember that. That basketball knowledge supersedes the number, okay? And on the flip side, which you said about using certain numbers for certain people, sometimes we may start a big kid on the block and a guard on the wing. We may screen down for that kid. The big kid may do a curl because she wants to post all the time because that's where she's good. And the player who set the screen might replace to the wing. So now you get a curl, post, reverse the ball, throw it inside. So some players do twos and try to curl off it. Some players are better three-point shooters, so they'll always try to tell their teammate to five screen for them, which is a flare screen for them to get out onto the wing, okay, and to shoot the three. So sometimes during the course of the numbers, sometimes I'll just tell them to play options, which means they do whatever they want. Whatever number they want to do, they do. And then sometimes I'll call specific numbers for different kids, and then they do the numbers that I call. So I know it sounds kind of goofy, but that's kind of the way we broke it down at Villanova.
No, I love it because it comes back to what you said about zone offense, which in my phrasing, I would say it goes from structure to unstructured, right? Like
correct.
This notion of just let them play in pure motion. I mean, it's really hard for kids and we're kind of setting them up for failure. So what you're saying is you're giving them structure, but above all else, make a basketball decision that makes sense, that supersedes everything. I think that's brilliant. I think that's great.
And that's what we're trying to do. Like, and that's why like sometimes you'll watch us play and we'll look really good because we're making all the proper decisions. I'm letting them play on their own. I'm letting them run the options. And then there's some games where we run the options, we look terrible because we're making bad basketball decisions. So it's kind of like, it's the same thing with everything else. Experienced teams do it better than inexperienced teams.
A whole bunch of questions, but how often do you change numbers from possession to possession, for example?
I would say if we're running the man offense 10 times, I will call probably six specific numbers that I want, and then I'll probably call three or four where they're playing on their own. So that's about the ratio, I would say.
Very cool. And do you go into games, obviously, based on scout, knowing the numbers you're going to emphasize for a specific opponent?
Yeah, sometimes. And then a lot of times that adjusts on how the game's going. But yeah, we would. If we think we can post up one of the players on our team, we'll tell her to do a lot of fours, which means when she screens away, she'll just slip into the post and post. And so if a team has a weaker inside game, a lot of times we'll use that against them. Like when we played DePaul this year, they weren't that big of a team. So we tried to constantly slip our screeners into the post or curl our big kids into the post. And we threw the ball inside a lot against them.
Same question I asked about zone then is, what are some things that have disrupted this 5-out offense the most over the years that you've had to learn how to adjust that?
Well, I think the obvious thing is denial of the ball. If you're not making good reads on your cuts, you know, and if the other team's more aggressive and denies you the ball, that will disrupt it. Also, the entry passes, kids have to learn how to pin and pop. A lot of times they just try to pop out and the other team's denying the ball. That will be very disruptive. And if the person's pressuring the point guard, trying to turn them constantly, that will disrupt us a little bit. So we have to learn how to play within those disruptions. Those are the things that you have to work on if you're trying to use motion to try to help yourself play against that kind of defense.
Well, and I know you've talked about this, and I assume it's still the case that there's no true secondary break. When you play transition, you're playing transition to score, and then you're just flowing into this, which essentially, again, becomes your secondary primary offense, right? No matter what you want to call it. Is that right?
That's correct. Like, when you run a secondary offense, that's a play, and people can scout the play. When you're running your stuff into motion, well, one time you're curling, another time you're flaring, another time you're slipping, you know what I mean? Another time you're back cutting, another time you're passing and going one cut, which is straight basket cut to the basket. So if you're looking at us, you're saying to yourself, well, you don't really know what we're going to run, okay? Because we don't really know what we're going to run. So that, to me, is what makes it kind of better than a secondary break.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And so I guess the other thing that you're trying to fight against, which I've seen 5-out offenses, and I ran one long time ago, and the robotic nature of it, that it becomes this single gap creation, one pass away, you know, no space, because players just keep doing the same action over and over again. What are some things that you've developed to be able to help players kind of counter that human nature to do the same thing over and over?
Yeah, I've tried to get them to understand, number one, you have to mix it up. And we'll do it at practice where we'll play 3-on-3 a lot, where they have to read the defense so they're not doing the same thing on different possessions. Also, the numbers help you stop them from doing the same things all the time. So if you see them doing too many curls, you say, listen, I don't want you to do any curls off the break. I don't want you to do flares. So that will help stop them from being robotical. Even though you're giving a specific thing for them to do, when you see them being too robotical, then you change it to something else. So you have more control over the game. It gives me a chance to get myself involved in the game. If I think they're doing something, like you said, too much, I can just change it by changing the numbers.
Yeah, that's good. And I guess back to that question about, you know, double gap creation, creating space to be able to drive. Is that an emphasis in, like, it's probably changed a lot over the years, but is that now a big emphasis within what you do?
Yeah, depending on, again, what kind of team we have. This team this year is not really good at it. Just one player is really good at it, or two players. So those two players within the offense will look to do it more. We've had teams in the past where we've had four or five players that were able to do it, and we let them do it. We also run, I'll call it a set play off the five out, where we're specifically getting the ball to one person for them to drive it. So we do recognize that, hey, either one or two or three people can drive the ball. We put plays in that specifically get them the ball to drive, and then they try to do it within the frame of the offense.
Well, and that's the case that this, because you run plays out of this five out two, that it masks the fact that a play is coming to the opponent. They can't really scout it because it looks the same as your motion, right?
Right. Unless they hear the call, they won't know it's a set play.
And back to the call then, how are you calling the numbers out? Or is that in the flow usually, or is it in advance? Is it dead balls? How are you calling
I can do it in whatever framework you just mentioned. Sometimes when the offense in the second half's in front of us, I will call it actually more in the flow of the game because they're all in front of me and they're all breaking in front of me. I can call it more there. The first half, I usually will call it more if the opponent scores and we're walking it up, then we'll call it then because the point guard has to relay it to the other kids on the team. So it changes on where you have the ball in the court. We've called it during timeouts. We've called it during foul shots, inbounds plays. So whatever suits my fancy in the game, we can change it. You know, we feel like we can make a change.
And with that, in either the motion or the plays, because you're spacing opponents somewhat to uncomfortable positions where you'll have some specific players on the opposite team that won't be as comfortable on the perimeter, are you doing things to hunt specific matchups to attack as well, either inside or outside?
Absolutely. A lot of times, you know, we'll have an advantage in our fours and fives because we'll be smaller and more mobile. So those are the specific advantage we are looking for off the break. If we can get the ball to a specific person, we'll call Villanova drive. But, you know, we're getting the ball to that person where they can go one-on-one against a big kid who might be slower than they are. So, yeah, we are doing that.
It's great stuff, and I encourage coaches to look at both these systems. Just again, a lot of common sense ideas that are brought together. So wonderful for you to share that. Now, Coach, maybe reflecting a little bit on yourself as a coach and the, you know, how much you've changed over 42 years. But knowing what you know now, what is some advice, maybe a few one or two advice or ideas that you can share with coaches about, hey, I wish I knew this when I first started.
Well, I just wish I knew more. I mean, sometimes I don't know if, you know, as a young coach in today's world or years ago, like we're paying attention to everything as much as we should. So, like I had the luxury of having like Rolly Massimino around me, and he would bring guys in like Larry Brown would come around, Chuck Daly would come around. Dave Gavitt would come around. Joe Mullaney Sr. would be around. So I had access to all those people. Nowadays, I don't know if young coaches have access to those kind of people. So they have to either seek them out through clinics or camps or whatever, and then try to wove their own ideas into a combination of ideas. Don't think that the way you do it is necessarily the best way to do it. You might have talent 1 or 2 years, and it seems like the best way to do it, but you always want to be able to share and combine ideas.
Well, it's great advice. And, you know, that's the idea of this podcast, Coach, is, you know, I think we've lost a little bit of that connection where we go to clinics, we go to camps, and we get access to the people you talk about. So the idea of the podcast is to be able to give people access to you a little bit through, again, what would a coach ask you in terms of those things? So hopefully that contributes a bit to it. How about dealing with players? What have you learned, some of the best practices for dealing with players, say, on the court, off the court, in terms of your interaction?
Well, it's kind of, again, it changes with every team. This particular team this year, very fragile group of kids. So you have to treat them with more like kid gloves. And then you may have a group where being tougher on them is actually better for them than treating them with kid gloves. So I think it's a read. You have to read that as a coach. And I think each team, each year, each group changes. So, and I think you have to try to change with them. I don't believe in just being one way all the time. I think you have to bend in the wind. I think you have to give kids today more, I don't know what the word is, access or more time that they can express their opinions. Kids today like to express their opinions much more than years ago that I found. And you have to be able to let them do that. Because I'll even let players during a game, you know, come up, give me ideas, say, hey, I think we can do a 2, or I think we can do a 4 over here, or whatever in the zone offense. Why don't you change me, you know, take me out of the point guard spot, put me on the baseline, something, whatever. So I think in today's world, you need to let them have more opportunities to speak their mind.
Awesome. That's awesome. Well, Coach, I'm not sure what's next for you, but I know you'll continue to be involved in the game and be able to share the game. And I cannot encourage coaches enough to be able to check out some of the philosophies and some of the ideas that you share. And I appreciate you taking the time to be able to share the game with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it too.
I am happy to announce that the Best in the West Coaching Clinic video series is now available for download. Get 11 full clinic videos featuring multiple sessions by Mike McKay, Alex Arama, Yorick Michaels, Chris Oliver, plus single sessions from Lisa Tomides, Shawnee Harley, and Dave Taylor. Go to www.bestinthewestclinic.com to watch a trailer and to learn more. Learn modern coaching ideas, not just on what to coach, but on how to coach as well, from some of the best coach educators currently sharing the game. A number of coaches have already reached out to me, grateful to be able to stimulate their coaching with so many unique ideas never shared or discussed on most coaching DVDs. Go to www.bestinthewestclinic.com. to get these videos to download, to be able to watch in the comfort of your home.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.